Yeah, but let's ensure that these guys are mic'd up so we don't lose any of their...
Man, this is cool. Just wireless everything.
Yeah, and... it feels a bit more natural than having all of these mics and yeah. All that stuff. So yeah.
Are you recording now?
It is indeed recording. Oh. So we are now live from the Oslo Event Hub here in the capital of Norway. Where, recording an English episode today, and it's because we have an English-speaking guest, and it's none other than Pete Warden. Welcome to Norway.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, and my name is Simen Flottefro, and I have a couple of guys with me here, and we are talking a bit about today's occasion. So you could introduce yourself, please.
I am Daniel Varming. I'm the founder and CEO of UiS Aerospace. We're a student organization in Stavanger that is building currently a 7-meter long rocket that we are trying to launch into space in 2026. And then we're doing a test flight in 2025 from our brand new spaceport, which is Utsira, that we just launched here today at the spaceport Norway.
We wish, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm Einar Eide. I'm a telemetry engineer for Propulse. Yeah, I'm actually quite new to this. So yeah. It's my first year in Propulse.
Is it your first time on a podcast with a guy from NASA? And
yes, it's former, also my first
former,
time.
Former NASA, former NASA and NASA, yeah. U.S. Air Force Brigadier General? Because that is what you are.
Couldn't you give us a bit of context? Because you, Daniel, is actually one of the reasons why this conversation is taking place in the first place.
Right. So what happened was in Spaceport Norway 2023, I was being a good boy, and I held the door open for a gentleman that came in to the conference, and it turned out it was Pete. Pete and I met for dinner later that night. We hit it off at the conference, and then Pete invited me to New Zealand. Long story short, Pete came to visit in Stavanger, and then we traveled to Spaceport Norway 2024 together. So Spaceport Norway is really a place where a lot can happen. And and Pete, of course, is the executive director of Breakthrough
Initiatives,
and also the chairman of the Breakthrough Prize Foundation.
Yeah.
Pete, could you tell us a little more about, maybe let's start with what you're doing now, because that's really exciting. You're working for Breakthrough.
One burning question.
Okay, sorry.
This is a very important one. How have you liked Norway thus far?
I like Norway. I've been here quite a lot. I worked for NASA for 9 years, and we visited several times. And I'm a solar physicist by background, and I actually had worked in some solar physics programs. There were some Norwegian scientists that were our co-investigators. But that's probably my 15th trip to Norway. And,
all right.
So
you're what we call a Norwegian friend.
Yes, right. I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Although my deputy is Swedish, so I...
we'll let that slide for this
episode. Let's not talk anymore about that.
Some other place to the east, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you've been spending some time together with the students this time around. So you have visited... UiS Aerospace in Stavanger, and you're supposed to come to Trondheim to visit Propulse and Orbit and all that, all the good stuff that's happening up there. But due to some unfavorable weather, we ended up not meeting until today. So what are your thoughts about day one of the Spaceport Norway conference?
What's really key, I think, to a successful space effort is getting sort of particularly younger people, but not just younger people, that want to start something new and are inspired by the, not just the idea of making money, but the idea of going into space, expanding human presence in the solar system. And, one of the things that I learned a long time ago, and a long time ago, I'm 75, so, is that it's a responsibility of every professional to replace themselves with people better than they are, which usually younger. So one of the things that I benefited from in my career was some very senior mentors and people helping me do things. And one of those included Edward Teller, who was the father of the hydrogen bomb in the United States.
How early in your life did these mentors start to play a role in your life? How young were you when you started on this path towards exploring space?
Well, I got started really early. I was interested in space, but to have people that sort of helped me really in my 20s. One of my mentors was Hans Mark, who was at one point the chancellor of the University of Texas. He was the deputy NASA administrator. Was a secretary of the Air Force, the civilian leader of the Air Force. And it very early on, I got to know him because I was a junior officer in the Air Force as a science officer, and some very senior scientist was angry with me. And so he knew the secretary of the Air Force, so he called him up, and this was Hans Mark, who told him, look, there's nobody more honest than Air Force captains. And he said, what did he do? And he said, well, he yelled at me and told me to do this, that, and the other thing. And said, well, that's his job. He works for the government, and we're giving you money. So that kind of got me out of trouble. Mm-hmm. But I later got to know Hans Mark pretty well, and he'd been a good mentor. Another mentor that I met in my 30s was General Benny Schriever, who was really the person that started the military space program. He developed the U.S. ICBMs in the 50s and was the chief of research and development for the Air Force for a while. And then there's other, been fortunate to meet other people that are kind of mentors. One of them is probably my, who I found the most philosophical inspiration is Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction author. And I had the privilege of meeting him, not when I was so young, but he was one of the first people I corresponded with on the internet in the 1990s when it started to become
a lot of military men who are your interest in space and like the guiding stars in your early career was these military men who were actually the precursors to the space program, like the ICBMs and all that stuff. Quite
well,
lucky.
I was a military officer. My father was a military officer. He was a bomber pilot in World War II.
Over Europe? Or
well, actually,
Pacific?
He didn't. That's a long story.
All right.
Just to get into details, he came in active duty in 1942, and he was trained to fly B-17s, but they had too many B-17 pilots. And they do everything in alphabetical order in the military, and Warden, my last name, is near the end. So they didn't need B-17 pilots, and they kept putting him on different bombers until finally he was on B-29s. And he was assigned to the group that was supposed to drop the atomic bomb on Germany. And, of course, the Germans, wisely surrendered.
Yeah. But he was stationed in the Pacific or in
No,
Germany?
He was in the United States. He was about ready to come to Europe when Germany collapsed.
Yeah, in Europe. Yeah.
The closest he got to combat is he flew a B-29 to Tinian Atoll just before the bombs were dropped. So I kind of grew up with airplanes.
Mm. So he could have been a quite historic man in that sense.
Yeah, he could have been, but I think he was probably glad that he wasn't.
Yeah, I'd second that.
But he was in the United States, each state has its own army and air force, which is kind of unique. It has to do with the way our Constitution constructed, although it doesn't have its own Navy. And so he was a part-time military pilot. So when I grew up, he flew for the Michigan Air Force and flew fighter planes. But he was a corporate pilot. But he encouraged me to get into airplanes. In fact, I had a pilot's license the same month I had a driver's license. I was always more interested in space. And I grew up during the Apollo program. I wanted to be an astronaut. Yeah, he persuaded me that joining the Air Force was the best way. I did eventually get, was a finalist to be an astronaut and didn't get selected. So I'm jealous about astronauts.
Yeah. Do you think that you would have pursued space in this manner if it wouldn't have been for the Apollo program?
Probably. As I grew up in the 1950s as a little boy, and one of the first books my mother gave me was a book called Stars, another one called Planets. And I actually, you know, rushed ahead to learn to read so I could read those books. Mm. And I asked my mother, I said, what do people do that study stars? She said, well, they're called astronomers. So ever since I was about 5 or 6 years old, I said, told people I wanted to be an astronomer. And of course, during the 60s, we had the Apollo program. And in 1967, I went to the University of Michigan. And I majored in astronomy, but there was 120 people that were going to major in astronomy. Six of us ended up getting degrees. Most of them discovered you need to know calculus, and so they dropped out. But two of us got doctorates, and I think I'm the only one still involved in space or science. But it's but I did join the Air Force, as my dad wanted me to do, and you know, one thing led to another. I ended up getting a delay to go on active duty to get my doctorate in astronomy. And I ended up spending 29 years in the Air Force.
Yeah, but were you a pilot at that time? Or
nope, I was a science officer.
Science.
I'm assuming you watched the moon landing.
Yes, I was 19.
Live. You were 19, damn. Amazing. And what can you tell us a little bit about what was that like watching that?
Well, it was in the summer, so I was home from college. And everybody was really excited about it. And, we had some of the neighbors over because I think my dad had bought a bigger color TV than they had. And one of his best friends, who was a fellow pilot, you know, said to me that, the movie 2001 had just come out. And he asked me, what did I think, that was too optimistic? And I said, no, I think we're going to be going to the stars in the 21st century. Unfortunately wrong, but we're still trying it.
Mm-hmm. And one of your mentors, Arthur D. Clarke,
yeah.
He said something interesting about this quote that you have quoted in one of your presentations.
Well, you know, Clarke was a, to my mind, one of the most visionary, you know, and he was a military officer during World War II and was a science officer. He helped develop the radar systems. And he, one of his, the quotes I really liked from him was that
we're either alone.
There are two possibilities for life in the universe. Either we are alone or we are not. He says both of them are equally terrifying.
And so what is being done... bring it back to what you do now. What is being done for finding life?
Well, I was the director at NASA's Ames Research Center for almost 10 years, and I was about to be fired for causing trouble.
Oh. And by whom?
By the NASA administrator.
Right.
Well, truth be told, I tried to get him fired, so he's probably fair to.
Can I ask?
We're good friends now, by the way.
Can I ask what did you do that would maybe get you fired?
Well,
you said you were causing some trouble.
I was an ally of the deputy administrator, was Lori Garver, and we wanted to terminate the shuttle and do a real space program. He was an astronaut. That was Charlie Bolden, and she didn't really want him as the administrator. And there's a long story of why he got picked, and so. She had come out to NASA Ames, and we showed her a biofuel program that you could actually breed algae to produce oil. And we needed about $10 million. She said, well, I'm the deputy administrator. I'd be able to give you $10 million. Well, she took it out of the aeronautics budget. The aeronautics director was mad that, you know, I had end-run him and got the money. So he complained to the administrator, and the administrator said, well, okay, I used to be on the board of Marathon Oil, and they're doing work on this. Let me ask them. And so he said, well, they said that what you're doing is bullshit. And I said, no, wait a minute. You know, when he called me, you know, I thought, you know, there's a law in the United States that if you get a political appointment that you can't talk to people that you were financially involved with, like on the board of directors, for a year. And so I said, okay, this is wrong. And so I sent the deputy administrator an email complaining about it. She or somebody close to her leaked it to the press. Mm. And so on nationwide television, you know, one of the announcers, you know, took him to task. And so he said, I don't want a disloyal person. And but fortunately, there were some congressmen in California that support our women, including Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House. So it was, got very heavily involved in politics.
But you've been fired
many times
on other occasions too by President Bush too.
Well, if you're not getting fired, you're not doing it right. The you've got to be ready to kind of, you know, the no, I was been fired of a number of jobs, but I'm still here. So
keep bouncing back up.
Well, the one I was a brand new brigadier general in 2001, and the 9-1-1 attack occurred. I knew the Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld. You know, he actually had talked to me about space a year before. He was running a space commission. And so he said, look, I want a flag officer, a general or an admiral, to give me different solutions than bombs and bullets. And so they said, well, where's somebody that's a little different than the rest? Well, there's this crazy space guy. And so they had me run something called the Office of Strategic Influence, which is an information warfare office, because I don't know anything about information warfare. But they also gave me an advisor who was Newt Gingrich, who was the former Speaker of the House. And so we figured out we really needed to do some information operations using modern technology. And the thing I came up with is say, look, the problem we had in these isolated regions like Afghanistan and Pakistan is a lack of access to global data. And so what we want to do is put internet, direct broadcast radios, and say that, if some religious person's telling somebody that if they strap this bomb in their butt, they can, you know, and blow it up, they'll see 70 virgins in paradise. My point was, if they go on the internet, they don't have to blow themselves up. They can just find them on the... I was in Pakistan, and the governor of the province of Baluchistan wanted to show he was a good ally, and so he, on the front page of their local newspaper, was me, one of these little radios, there was a New York Times reporter in the hotel, and so he said, can I talk to you, General Warden? And I said, I suppose so. And so I figured I wasn't going to lie to him what we were doing. Well, that was somehow assumed that we were going to do disinformation. So there was a big article on the front page of the New York Times with my picture on it. My wife called me and says, why is your picture on the front page of the New York Times? I said, dear, that's never good news for a government employee. Trust me. It caused quite a furor of disinformation office. The Secretary of Defense said, look, just keep quiet. It'll be fine. But then one of my enemies was the head of public affairs in the Pentagon, and she got one of her friends to ask the president, President Bush, the junior President Bush, that are you going to tell Secretary of Defense to shut down that disinformation office? And he said, I don't need to tell him what to do. He knows what to do. So I was shunted out and given a non-job and retired from the Air Force, but a general officer that doesn't have a real job is dangerous. And so I ended up working for the last 2 years I was in the Air Force as helping the head of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, kind of as his advisor. And among other things, we set up a program that ended up giving Elon Musk his first government contract for the Falcon 1. Amazing. So I got to know Elon pretty well.
Cool.
And
You drive in his Roadster?
Yeah.
That is orbiting around Earth as we speak?
Yes. He gave me a ride in it. I think that's the same one. And it, he wanted to build the Teslas. We had these old 1930s airship hangars, and he was going to put his factory there. It turned out we couldn't come up with an agreement that we could get through the lawyers. But so he said, come on over. And there was only like four or five of those that he had built then, and so he wanted to know if I wanted to drive it, and I said, no, you can drive it. And it goes like a bat out of hell. I mean, it was quite impressive.
And you you led the investigation board for one of the crashes of
Falcon.
Well,
yeah, when the you know, I was I'd gotten out of the Air Force soon after that, and I was still kept on as a consultant for DARPA. And before he got ready to launch, they asked me to go out and take a look at it. I was unimpressed with the operational rigor. So I wrote a rather scathing negative report and sent it to him. He wrote back an even worse letter and said that I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. I was an astronomer, not a rocket scientist. And I wrote back, well, first I had a nasty one, but I didn't send it to him. I wrote back a nice one and said, you're right. I am not a rocket scientist. I think for all I know, your rocket technology is great. I said, but I was a military research officer, was involved in 50 or 60 research development programs, and I noted that some of those had characteristics that were common that made them work, others that were common that made them didn't work. And I said, bluntly, your operation didn't have much in common with those that worked and a lot with those that didn't. So my prediction stands that that's going to fail. A week later, it launched, it went up a kilometer and blew up. So the DARPA director said, you'll be a chair of the oversight or the failure investigation board. But, you know, Elon is a brilliant guy, and after you point out this stuff, he fixed it.
Cool.
You know, did you go down to Kwajalein at all for this?
Yep, I was there with him.
Damn.
And,
did you fly down in his private
jet? No, I was a military person.
Military private jet.
Yeah, you flew in a you flew in a commercial airline in the coach seat.
So today at this conference we are approximately 100 students, and we are not any 100 students. Like, we are a bunch of young people who are very much interested in space, as you were way back when, and still are, of course. And of course, we did not have the Apollo program growing up. And frankly, we didn't really have too many programs growing up. Like, the space shuttle was one thing, but it wasn't the same explorational inspiration and motivation associated with that program. But something that has at least sparked my motivation the past, let's say, 5, maybe a bit more years, is the private sectors, especially on the launch side of things. And I, of course, read the book When the Heavens Went on Sale, and that's where I first heard about your name. And that book describes the struggles and the like the ups and downs of starting a young and aspirational private company within the space sector. It covered Rocket Lab, it covered
Astra
and Firefly Aerospace, and even Planet Labs.
Yep.
So could you give a brief intro to your why were you in that book?
Well, first of all, I'm sort of inspired by younger people who don't know why you can't do things. And so I tend to, you know, work with younger folks just as my mentor has worked with me. And there was a group of, I guess I call them sort of leftist, who formed this UN Space Generations Advisory Council. And I was a brigadier general, and I went to the IAC. It was held in Houston. And I went to have a drink in a bar with a colleague of mine, and there's about 10, 15 young people over there having a big argument about space weapons. And it was clear that they didn't like space weapons. And, of course, I spent a lot of my career developing said things. And I said, do they know that Darth Vader is sitting over here? And the guy with me says, no. I said, do you know him? He said, oh, yeah, I'll introduce you to him. So they brought me over and introduced him. Most of them ran away. Yeah. But Will Marshall came on over to talk, or Robbie Shingler, and George Whitesides, who just got elected as a congressman in the U.S., and so we had a big argument. But then I said, look, rather than argue, why don't we write a paper together about... I said, we're not even using the same words. And so I got to know them really well. And every year they had a New Year's sort of 3 or 4 day, you know, kind of meeting, and they used to invite me to these. And at those, Chris Kemp was there. Mm-hmm. And it, I soon got kind of as a booby prize for getting fired. I eventually got offered to go have a NASA center. And so I was going to be the director of NASA Ames. And it, so I told them, why don't you come with me? So so I had sort of a group of young troublemakers, and I empowered them and shielded them from the bureaucratic assholes, mm-hmm. firing some of them, the assholes. And, you know, they caused me a lot of trouble, but they also did amazing things. Mm-hmm. And you know, at that time, NASA Ames, it was one of the 10 NASA centers. It's the one in Silicon Valley. You know, we sort of turned it into a new space center. And sort of probably a dozen different companies came out of that effort. I got to know Google really well and worked with Google CEO Eric Schmidt, who I'm still working with. And you'll hear more about what he's doing here soon. Mm-hmm. But... you know, it was a really fun time, but you know, whenever you change things in the government, you're usually a target too. So eventually the antibodies will get you. So, but one of my big messages is don't be afraid of failing or being fired. That's one of the problems I saw in Europe that I think is being fixed. But one of the problems in Europe is that if you fail, that's the biggest disaster. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that really powered Silicon Valley is the view that it's not bad to fail. In fact, it's good. Fail early and often. Mm-hmm. And it's...
But always forward.
Fail forward. Well, I mean, you might fall backward a little bit. But
I think it's worth mentioning that the companies that you were involved in, they were young, ambitious.
Yep. And a lot of them failed.
Yeah, but still, they reached orbits, like Firefly, Astra, and Rocket Lab, like these American and this one New Zealand initiative that actually reached orbit, something that Europe is now, as of now, still struggling towards doing privately, at least. So have you seen any, have you been involved at all in any of the rocket startups that have been, that have sprung up across Europe?
Yeah. Well, not a lot. RFA. I mean, I've, at various times I've, you know, visited, you know, like some of the launch complexes, like in Kiruna and here, and there've been companies in Germany, for example, that have tried to do things. A lot of them came out of ESA, so I think they had too much government sense. But I think it's the right approach. You know, first of all, you guys are having fun, and you know, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. Mm. And it's there's a lot of unpleasant times, but in the end, it's. It's worth it when that rocket goes up.
Yeah. Would you say that's a big key to success for these people, that they're doing something that they're really passionate about and really love?
Well, and I mean, it's yes. I think it's to be passionate about it and believe in a unlimited future. I mean, when I met Musk the first time, that was what he wanted to do. He's wanted to settle Mars, and he's going to do it, by God.
Yeah, many of
the world's richest man. Now he ought to be able to do it.
Yeah.
In the best friend forever of the new president of the United States. So.
So he has chosen the hardest thing to do, and everyone wants to work at his companies, and it's seemingly actually going to make it, as you say.
But, you know, I mean, there will be more people like Musk, and, you know, you guys might be one of them, so.
Yeah, many of us students here are probably interested in working with space after we're done studying, maybe going into, like, kind of space startups that you have helped start up. I'm wondering if you have any... like similarities you can see in the startups that worked out and the startups that failed. Like what should we try to do and what should we try to avoid
doing? Well, there's
a
couple things. In fact, I've had a presentation I gave on that, but there's the first thing is when you do a startup, there's a handful of people.
Yes.
And the first thing is choose your partners carefully. because you're going to spend more time with them than you are with spouses or families or anything else. So you better be able to live with these people, you know, 18 hours a day. And a lot of startups fail because the founders, you know, didn't carefully decide, okay, I really like these people and I want to work with them and we have like-minded. So that's the first thing, is just make sure you're all on the same sheet of music, as we'd say in the U.S. Right. And the second one, I think, is a willingness to fail, and don't get, you know, say, okay, that didn't work, so we won't do that again. And the third one, and this is where a lot of companies fail, and I think this is, at least in the United States, it's fairly easy to get investment money. But it's also too easy to sell too much of your company and to become a, you know, so you dilute, you know, you really want non-dilutive funding. So this government grants or other things to start with, I think it's important, because you can find somebody that's willing to give you money. In fact, Rocket Lab is a good example. I mean, Peter Beck sold half his company, and so he doesn't own the company now. I mean, he's, you know, he runs it, but and I think he probably, if he'd had it to do over again, wouldn't have done that.
Would you say that there were an alternative to this path for Rocket Lab? As in, were there enough paying, let's say, customers or investors that were not venture and wanted immediate return on investment?
Well, being in New Zealand is a hard, you know, I mean, there's sure. Not, because it wasn't a space country and didn't have any government interest in it. But, yeah, I think it's just be careful of you know, how much, you know, who are you selling yourself to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because would you say that if that some of these examples you mentioned have sold too much, so that sort of lost the vision that they started out with?
Well, I mean, you know, in order to raise money, you have to sell equity. So at some point, you no longer control the company or even have enough. So it's your investors that control the company. And, you know, sometimes investors care about space. Usually they don't. And so they will make decisions that aren't necessarily in the best decision of the long-term health of your company.
Yeah.
They're making a decision that's in the long-term health of their investment. And some of them are anxious to get to an IPO. You know, some will begin to make decisions on who's going to be the CEO that might not be the best person, but it's the one that they feel is the best salesman or something.
Yeah.
So I it's just to be careful to make sure that if you're a founder, that you stay in control.
Yeah.
Now, okay, it helps if you were Elon Musk and made, you know, $750 million from, PayPal. But, you know, it's not necessarily true. I mean, in some cases, both Musk and Bezos made money elsewhere in order to do that. I met Bezos a long time ago, and he claims I persuaded him to do reusable rockets, because one of the programs I did in the military was the DCX reusable rocket. And I finally met him in Seattle, and we met him in a coffee shop. You know, where else would you meet in Seattle but a coffee shop? I don't think it was a Starbucks, but he's kind of an unassuming guy. And, you know, he's much nicer to talk to than Musk is, by the way. That doesn't mean he's a nicer guy. It just means he's more collegial. But he did tell me, he said, look, my true love is to build rockets. And he said, I sell books in order so I can build rockets. And I said, okay, you sell a lot of books and other things. But I one of the things, if you want an investor, you know, try to find sometimes an investor that has the same vision that you do, you know, that really is interested in the space stuff.
Another challenge that we sort of touched upon in the introduction to the conference today with the Ministry of Trade, with the State Secretary, is that in Norway you have a challenge where if you create a company and it's valued quite high, you pay taxes on your unrealized gains of of the company. That's just a comment.
Yeah, that's kind of stupid.
I agree, and I hope the politicians do something about it. Stephen, you were saying.
I saw I was kind of in the middle of an example of what you just said about choose your investors wisely, because, and your founders for that matter also, because past 3 months I spent some time in Germany in one of these startup rocket companies, and I got to see a quite different approach between the two German ones, Munich-based ones. You have RFA and you have ISAR Aerospace. And whether it's deliberate or not, RFA has chosen to go, or has ended up not being as venture heavy compared to ISAR. So at RFA, they have mostly like satellite customers who have invested in their company, because that will end up in them, their satellites being able to be sent to orbit. Whilst on the other hand, you have ISAR, which has a lot more of these venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. And you can see a quite different approach in how they market their progress, for instance. RFA was quite open. Like, you knew where along their timeline they were, whilst ISAR right now, even though they're launching in Norway, the country that we are in right now, it's quite hard to get any sort of updates about how they're doing stuff. And I've gotten the impression that this is to a large degree because of how their investment scene is looking. They have to be more cautious. And of course, RFA, they had quite a notable anomaly in August, where the first stage actually blew up during a static fire test. But still, this is some information that they went out with rather, like on the same evening even. And
rather than keeping it secret?
Rather than keeping it secret. And from the impressions that I've gotten, their investors haven't been scared away. Whilst if ISAR would have blown up in a similar fashion, it might have been a bigger discrepancy from what they have promised or what the investors are interested in seeing of a development. So it was quite interesting to see that there are two different approach going on right now, and let's see which ones prove to be the most
fruitful.
Yeah.
Well, SpaceX's original investors, which I know some of them, key ones, were all rocket people. Mm-hmm. Wanted to do rockets. Mm. One of the key ones is Steve Jurvetson. Mm. And, you know, I met him. He was leading an amateur rocket company for kids. And so I let him launch his rockets from NASA Ames Airfield. And he's the kind of guy that, look, he wants to see humanity expand into space. And so if you can get them, those are the right investors. The other key thing, I think, is to keep track of. You have to have some revenue stream. There are too many companies that say, well, in 15 years I'll have a great revenue stream. Well, that doesn't cut it. Usually you need to have some product. You know, it may be a component that you sell
along the way,
so that you've got a revenue stream that's credible.
So you need to go in about 6 minutes. You're giving another talk, but could you briefly tell us what you're doing now, please, in Breakthrough Initiatives? Because you have three very exciting projects.
Well, we have two left, but we had the whole idea of Breakthrough Initiatives is to answer the key questions of life in the universe, and it really is: are we alone? First question: is there any life elsewhere? And that's a pretty exciting one. And the second one is there any intelligent life elsewhere? And the third one, which I found most exciting, but we put it on hold because our sponsor is skeptical, is can we travel to the nearest star systems, which to me is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And so we're making progress on at least two of them. And I think we made good progress in the third. But, you know, the interesting thing about philanthropic funding is you have to understand that it's not my money. And it's somebody else's dream, and as long as it aligns, then they'll continue to fund it. And you need to find other sources of money. You can get it from governments, you can make it yourself, or persuade some billionaire to do it. I've done all three, but I haven't made it myself yet. So I just did a startup here last year. So we'll see whether that goes.
Yeah. One more thing. Do you think that there is intelligent life out there? Or any life, for that matter?
I'm virtually certain there is life everywhere.
Yes.
I think the galaxy is infected with life. Intelligent is a funny question. first of all, we can't define life very well at all. And you certainly can't define intelligence. And it's, I suspect that there's going to be very sophisticated entities everywhere that might be conscious, but whether you would call them intelligent and recognize them is highly uncertain, which is about what I'm going to talk about in here.
One last sentence from you. There are a lot of space nerds, students in specifically, who are listening to this podcast. One sentence. Any advice for them if they want to help explore the universe and find the meaning of life?
Never give up.
Simple as that.
Fantastic.
Pete Warden, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.